Make sure you're subscribed to Issues Etc. Type Issues Etc. in your podcast provider, hit that subscription button, and leave us a 5-star review. This will make it easier for other podcast listeners to find Issues Etc.
This is Jeff Schwarz, General Manager of Lutheran Public Radio, with a message for listeners in the Mountain and Pacific time zones. We pledge to have Issues Etc. podcasts posted daily, no later than 5 p.m. Mountain, 4 p.m. Pacific. This will allow you to download and listen to the latest Issues Etc. podcast weekdays during your evening commute. Again, if you live in the Mountain or Pacific time zone, download Issues Etc. before you leave work and listen during your drive home.
When it comes to children who don't have the wherewithal to determine their own bedtimes, their own sugar intake, no, children absolutely have a right to have their bodies protected.
If science is not humble in the sense that it recognizes the profound limits of its own knowledge and the profound limits of what it can know, once science loses that humility, then it becomes dangerous.
We have to pretend in all of these ways because what we really want is what we want. I don't want to have a kid. Of course, I've already engaged in unreality because I pretended that what I was doing was not the child-making thing.
At the end of the day, the missional church can say, yes, we've made disciples, but no, actually they haven't. They've just manipulated the Bible for the purpose of having people achieve very narcissistic and self-focused goals in their life.
This is Joel from Nebraska, and vocal musician Love Issues Etc. A mighty fortress is our God, a trusty shield and weapon. He helps us.
A headline from today's New York Times: when faith and politics meet, two Times journalists talk about the challenges of covering religion during a pandemic in a campaign season. Not just any two Times journalists, but the two religion beat journalists for the New York Times. You might say, I didn't even know that the New York Times still had a religion beat. Well, they do. Big questions remain, though. How does it work in the New York Times? How does the religion beat interact with the politics desk or the news desk? How do those stories get handed out properly? Well, that's not answered in this Q&A, but there are some other answers. And of course, white evangelicals come up in their support for Trump as well. Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. live on this Wednesday afternoon, October the 28th. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We'll be talking with Terry Mattingly about that New York Times Q&A with its two religion reporters. After that, we're going to spend some time talking with Jeremy Lamont. It's Issues Etc. Reformation Week. Our theme is Paths to Lutheranism. We will recount his path from Mormonism to Lutheranism. Then we're going to spend some time with you, our listeners, reading your email and listening to your comments from the Issues Etc. comment line. That email address, talkback@issuesetc.org, and the comment line, 618-223-8382. Joining us to talk about a New York Times Q&A with its two religion reporters, Terry Mattingly, senior fellow at the Overby Center at the University of Mississippi, author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion. He's founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
A lot of what we're going to walk over here in the next half hour is old stuff for regular listeners to our segments here. But why is this worth revisiting?
Well, you tell me. Why do you think it's worth revisiting?
I don't think I've ever seen, of course, I'm not a, kind of a journalistic insider. I don't think I've ever seen something like a Q&A with the two religion reporters. I didn't even know that they had two religion beat reporters at the New York Times, but I don't think I've ever seen it in the pages of the New York Times.
Well, it's I don't know whether it's in the pages of the New York Times. It's on the website. I have seen features of this kind with people on the religion beat, but you know, then again, this is my life and this is what I spend all my time doing. People like Bobby Ross Jr. and others have done an excellent job for us through the years keeping in touch with kind of the culture of the people who cover things on the religion beat. We also did a lot of coverage of the New York Times searching for religion reporters, and they hired one, Elizabeth Diaz, and then the position stood open for a long time. And it was in the context of it standing open that you had a quote, you know, from the editor during an interview on National Public Radio when he said, let's face it, our newspaper doesn't get religion very well, which I thought was a catchy phrase. And you have this sort of discussion of inside baseball stuff on the beat occurs among religion reporters all the time. It was interesting that at this moment you saw these two professional religion reporters, and I will do this. The New York Times went out and hired people with experience on the beat. Now, you would expect that when you're dealing with, you know, the newspaper of record for the United States. And I would say that in terms of evaluating religion coverage of the New York Times, with the arrival of these two, I would say, frankly, that among the Get Religion staff and people we hear from, that how people view religion coverage of the New York Times has changed and improved. In particular, we saw some very interesting coverage of Amy Coney Barrett as a person, as a believer, as someone who was an interesting symbolic figure among conservative religious women, etc. And we saw quite a bit of sensitivity there in some of those pieces. The question, of course, is, are those the pieces that matter the most to the New York Times? Which brings us back to that Get Religion theme over 17 years, which is that the true religion of elite media in America is politics, which means when religion gets close to politics, that's usually where the coverage swings over to the investigative reporters and the political reporters at the more prestigious desk. There's one other interesting thing about this interview that I was kind of hoping it would come up as I read through it when I saw it. Do you have any idea where these two women both went to college?
Well, that's an interesting question. No.
They are both graduates of Wheaton College. Now, when one with a degree in theology and the other with a degree in political science, Wheaton is a school that I have, to be perfectly honest with you, debated with administrators there about whether or not they should do journalism as a degree for years. Years ago, I spoke at an event at Wheaton celebrating an anniversary in the fact that they had a graduate degree in journalism. They had an MA, even though they didn't have an undergraduate department of journalism, which I thought was very interesting. And at this event, they had a card, you know, with the program for the evening, and Fred Barnes was the keynote speaker from Washington, and some of the others of us were there teaching and doing workshops and everything else. This was in the early 90s. I seem to remember I was still at Denver Seminary when this happened. But what was fascinating was on the back of this card, it had a list of prominent Wheaton MA graduates in journalism and where they are now. And what I thought was fascinating is I looked at the whole list, and almost every single name on the list, I think I counted three names that were on this long two-column list. I think I counted three that were actually in the mainstream press. Everyone else was in the world of evangelical media, Christian publishing, Christian public relations, Christian social work, et cetera, et cetera. They had produced almost no one who went into the mainstream press. And it wasn't that long after that, I seem to remember it being like 2 years, 3 years or so, that they closed down the MA. When I was doing my work in Washington, I had an interesting encounter with, I will simply say, a high official at Wheaton. And I was arguing that Wheaton should consider, maybe as a joint degree between communications and their English department and whatever else, that they really did need a unique Wheaton approach to doing journalism and to take journalism seriously and study it. And this administrator, in a quote that I, after this happened, after this encounter, I went over and wrote it down, he said that he was sure that the Wheaton faculty would never approve a degree plan in, and I quote, a subject as shallow and relentlessly anti-intellectual as journalism, unquote. Which sort of, doesn't that sound kind of like an elite liberal arts view of journalism? And I responded by saying, I actually see journalism as a huge part of studies of the First Amendment, American literature in the 20th century, free speech, which of course is a part of the First Amendment. I can link journalism to all kinds of liberal arts curriculum, and I have done so at two Christian liberal arts colleges. He wasn't impressed, and I finally said, well, sir, one of the fastest growing degrees on your campus, if I remember, is in like video editing. Could you tell me how journalism is less relevant to the liberal arts college curriculum than, say, technology of video editing or something like that? So anyway, Wheaton is an interesting place to get two brilliant women who cover religion and how they ended up in journalism. And we did, in the Washington Journalism Program, have a few students from Wheaton through the years, and I must confess they were excellent, fantastic, and I always wished we had had more, which is why I kept this ongoing debate with the administration there on why they should have a journalism program. But you didn't ask for that. But it is interesting to note that both Elizabeth Diaz, the person who's been on the beat there now for a couple of years, and the recent arrival, Ruth Graham, not to be confused with Ruth Bell Graham, certainly the wife of Billy Graham, and I don't know of any family relation or anything there, but Elizabeth Diaz and Ruth Graham are both from Wheaton College, which would have to be one of the more elite, in whatever sense you want to use that word, evangelical institutions in America.
A lot of the questions in the Q&A with these two Religion Beat New York Times reporters had to do with the nexus of politics and religion, had to do not only, and I want to get to a rather egregious observation by one of them about white evangelicals in a minute, but they seem aware of the fact that there is a political, I think one of the reporters used the term political frame that they are tempted to cast around every story, even in the Religion Beat. What did you make of that?
Well, the route to page one is politics. I mean, you could have a fascinating in-depth story on trends among baby boomers for how to handle their funerals, and that might get you some terrain in the feature section or in the magazine even, if the story is good enough. But everyone knows that the way you get on page one in an American newspaper with a religion story is you relate it either to scandal, financial or sexual or both, or politics. As we put it at Get Religion, politics is real. Politics is how most newsrooms, certainly elite newsrooms, politics is the lens through which they view reality. This is how things actually happen. It's actually quite materialistic in the philosophical sense. You have to have ways to do good things in the world, and the way you do good things in the world is through politics. And politics is like an ongoing Olympics. It's covered like a sport. Who's headed up? Who's going down? Who said something stupid yesterday? Who didn't? And when you force religion into that framework, bad things almost always happen. And I would argue that if good things happen in coverage of religion and politics, they almost always happen when you have a teamwork approach involving a professional from the political desk and an experienced religion writer who work together to cover the story, at which point you have two different sets of vocabularies, two different sets of sources, two different ways of looking at this. And I have seen some fine reporting through the years that occurred when editors consider doing this. However, I would say that that approach tends to be rather rare. I mean, so just to put it in the context of Amy Coney Barrett, a story about Amy Coney Barrett, the fascinating conservative woman, and what she means to conservative women across America, what her family means, what her education means, what her work means. That's a great story, and you saw a good version of that. You saw a good job of that at the New York Times. But when you get to stuff that's going to come up in the hearings, when she's actually up for consideration for the Supreme Court, when you get to whether or not this People of Praise group she is a part of is like really strange and bizarre, and what do they believe, and how do they clash with Pope Francis? You're going to see that usually handled by the political team, because after all, that story is important. In my own life and experience, and this goes a long time back, a dear friend of mine and a trailblazer on the religion beat once asked his editor, when the Jonestown massacre occurred, this veteran religion writer friend of mine approached his editor and said, I want to be assigned to that story. That's all about religion. The head of that cult was a liberal religious figure from San Francisco. You cannot understand them without understanding religion. And the editor basically told him, no, this is a really important story. This isn't a religion story. He didn't say it in those words, but that's exactly what he meant. Looking at it, my friend traced and didn't find a single religion reporter who was allowed to take part in coverage of the Jonestown massacre, because it was just too important to be a religion story. And that was something that I turned up in my graduate project at the University of Illinois all the way back in the early 80s, that this was one of the biggest problems on the religion beat. The bigger the story, if it involves religion, the less likely it will be allowed to be covered by a religion beat professional.
We're talking with Terry Mattingly about a New York Times Q&A with its two religion reporters. He's founder and editor of Get Religion. Stay tuned.
Criticism.
I just had to call in to respond to this week's installment of Never Trump Drivel from Terry Mattingly.
Compliments.
I love the interviews and insights because they help me battle the slings and arrows of outrageous theology in practice.
Clarification.
Is there a point where, without baptism, infants go to heaven, and after which time they go to hell if they're not baptized?
The Issues Etc. comment line, 618-223-8382.
For your next family vacation, consider Our Beach House, a charming three-bedroom vacation rental on beautiful Siesta Key. Just off Sarasota, Florida, Siesta Key Beach, consistently voted America's best, is just 100 steps away. Whether you're watching the sunset over the Gulf of Mexico or frolicking in the warm surf, you and your family will fall in love with Siesta Key. Check us out at SiestaKeyRentalGenie.com or call Virginia at 941-266-1858.
Education and edification. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Is your school or homeschool ready to take the next step in teaching students with learning challenges? We can help. The Simply Classical curriculum, voted number one for special learners, is available from Memoria Press for students with autism, learning disabilities, or Down syndrome. We provide everything you need for a full year. Use promo code LPR21 at simplyclassical.com. Simplyclassical.com.
The seasons are changing, the weather cooling, and it's almost time to commemorate All Saints' Day and the Reformation. That means it's the perfect time of year to celebrate our faithful pastors. Ad Crucem has an excellent selection of gifts for clergy. Come and see our pictorial crucifixes, Christmons, posters, art, greeting cards, wooden plaques, or, if you can't decide your favorite, purchase a gift card of any denomination. Visit adcrucem.com. That's ADCRUCEM.com.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about a New York Times Q&A with its two religion reporters. Terry Mattingly is our guest, senior fellow at the Overby Center at the University of Mississippi, author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion, and he's founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, what did you make of Elizabeth Diaz's answer to the question, how is covering religion during the 2020 election different than in 2016?
Well, why don't you just, do you have that quote in front of you?
I sure do. It says,
why don't you read it, and with your own voice, why don't you underline things?
Okay.
that you find interesting.
This is Elizabeth Diaz. So much was revealed in 2016. The political influence of prosperity gospel preachers who connect faith with financial wealth and the complete marriage of white evangelicals to President Trump, the depth of the racial divides within Christianity. What do you make of that answer?
Well, let's unpack that a little. We'll start with just kind of an interesting irony there. If you're looking for congregations in America in which you will find large numbers of white Christians sitting in the pew with large numbers of black Christians, you will almost always find those congregations in the context of charismatic and Pentecostal Christianity. A Pentecostalism, of course, is an example of a religious movement, the fastest growing one in the world, which for the most part springs out of the Azusa revivals in the United States on the West Coast. And from the get-go, this has been the most racially inclusive form of Christianity in American life. So if you're looking for a place where a racial divide is being closed in some way in American life, you're not going to find it at your local Unitarian church, Episcopal church, or pick any of the other seven sisters of liberal mainline Protestantism, the churches that would probably make the biggest point of racial inclusion, et cetera, are not the churches where you're going to find that happening. So to me, one of the most interesting stories in America is the fact that the prosperity gospel preachers who have been around for decades, but in the land of megachurch and television and whatever, if you're going to look at integration in American Protestantism, as opposed to racial issues and the complex ethnic issues within Catholicism, you're going to end up talking to prosperity gospel people, or, and here's the crucial part, you're going to end up talking to charismatic and Pentecostal Christians who reject the prosperity gospel. And this, I think, is the main point that I'd like to make. Way too often in the elite newsrooms of the Acela Zone, you know, the rapid trains that run up and down the East Coast from Washington to Boston, the Acela Amtrak trains, they fail to capture the intriguing conflicts and divisions inside Pentecostalism, inside evangelicalism, inside Catholicism, although they take Catholicism on because it's so big and it's so obvious and their editors want them to cover it. So that's just one point, which brings us straight to the next one, the complete marriage of white evangelicals to President Trump. Now, at this point, I imagine our listeners for this podcast, veteran listeners, people who listen all the time, throwing their hands up in the air, because this is something we've talked about over and over and over. But that doesn't mean it isn't true and it isn't important. The 81% of white evangelicals just love Trump, or are the complete marriage of white evangelicals to President Trump. I would argue that the complete marriage of white evangelicals to President Trump is something that's true at the New York Times, but it is not true in the United States of America, specifically in the half of the nation that the Times doesn't seem to want to cover very much, especially if the reporters are from the political beat. Let me state right up front that Elizabeth Diaz and Ruth Graham seem to be showing interest in that other half of America, and that's why I see promise for a lot of what they're doing. That complete marriage of white evangelicals and President Trump is contradicted greatly in the poll data. And you see it most strongly. What I've always quoted is the Christianity Today polling data that came out right before the 2016 election, in which they noted that, yes, about 80% of white evangelicals were poised to vote for Donald Trump, but only half of those people wanted to do so. Thus, we have the Trump base among evangelicals who supported him in the primaries, and then we have the Trump vote in the main election from evangelicals, which are two completely different things. The second being a much more complex situation with most of those people, or half of those people, saying that they were not voting for Donald Trump. They were voting because they felt they had no other option, and they felt they had to vote against Hillary Clinton, and specifically who Hillary Clinton would appoint to the Supreme Court. The other book that I've recommended over and over and over is Tim Carney's book, Alienated America. That should be on the shelf of must things to read for anybody who's going to follow what happens to evangelicalism after this election. Because one of the things he gets into there is the fact that in Iowa, in intensely, intensely evangelical sections of Iowa, the more you went to church as an evangelical, the more evangelicals went to church in Iowa, the less likely they were to vote for Trump. Now, they were still Republicans, and they were going to vote Republican because of a host of different issues that really mattered to them. But these were not the early Trump adapters. So that's the phrase that jumps out with me as just once again, the mythology of the nation's most powerful newsroom in refusing to see the complexities within evangelical Christianity in America. And we could get into so many other topics related to that. I mean, but I would just say over and over that they wanted to talk, for example, about QAnon. And I would say, is QAnon normal evangelicalism in America, or is QAnon, for the most part, people who have been pushed out, especially of leadership, within normal evangelicalism? There's a statement in this interview from Ruth Graham where she says, I'm actually starting work on a Q-adjacent story right now. It's a movement that has really taken off among Christian conservatives, and some have argued that QAnon is best understood as a homegrown religious movement. I would agree with part of that. I'd say it's a political cult, a phrase that Joe Carter, former Get Religionista, has used. I believe QAnon is a political cult that has learned how to speak religion. And yes, a lot of its followers are using it as a form of substitute religion. But has that influenced mainstream evangelical leadership, seminaries, and cultures? I think they would find the answer to that is no. So we just needed one more word in that sentence. It's a movement that has taken off among some Christian conservatives. Just that word some, S-O-M-E, would put the New York Times on track to doing some much more accurate reporting.
Terry, with just a few minutes, the section of the website for the New York Times where this appeared, this Q&A appeared, is called Times Insider, among other things. The section is devoted to delivering behind-the-scenes insights into how our journalism comes together. Did you get any insights into how religion journalism comes together in the New York Times organization?
No, none whatsoever. I think the really critical question, like so many things in journalism, has to do with how stories originate, who approves the ideas, to use the Hollywood term, who greenlights them. But most importantly, who are the members of the team, the editors of the stories, the writers of the stories, and most importantly, the editors above the editors, the folks that approve the story, who kind of in the initial conversation make sure that the reporters and the editors know what they think is important, and all the news that's fit to print. You remember that famous statement from Bill Keller, who said, the former editor that we quote so often at Get Religion, who said, we really need to change our motto from all the news that's fit to print to all the news that fits to print and what it means to you. Who's on the team that decides and what does it mean to you? And that's usually more than just the reporters themselves. There'll be editors at multiple levels of the paper that make those decisions. And I stress again, the more a story is viewed as something heading to page one, the more it's going to be framed as an important story, and that importance will almost always be stated in political terms.
Terry Mattingly is Senior Fellow at the Overby Center at the University of Mississippi. He's author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate in the book Pop Goes Religion, and he's founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, thank you.
Glad to be here.
Issues Etc. Reformation Week continues when we come back from the break. Our theme is Paths to Lutheranism. We'll talk about Jeremy Lamont's trip from Mormonism, a cradle Mormon, to the Lutheran Confession next. What's the relationship between the Book of Proverbs and the Ten Commandments? Find out with the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for October, Provoking Proverbs, Wisdom, and the Ten Commandments. It's a new 10-lesson Bible study produced by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040, or read an excerpt of Provoking Proverbs at issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for October, Provoking Proverbs, Wisdom, and the Ten Commandments. 1-800-325-3040.
I'm Chaplain Sean Denzer, Director of Worship for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Congregations work hard to keep the Word of Christ dwelling richly in His disciples now and into eternal life. We work to help and support that effort. Learn more at lcms.org/worship. You'll find resources on the church year, Bible studies on the hymns of the day, audio helps for learning to sing our services, and look for worship planning resources to find the latest from LCMS Worship. That's lcms.org/worship. May the Word of Christ dwell richly in you.
Our Christian faith is under constant attack, and we must be proactive in keeping our children in the church. At Faith Lutheran School in Plano, Texas, we believe that an education rooted in God's Word is one that stands against the very gates of hell. Nothing in this world is more important. Offering a rigorous classical Lutheran education, we provide in-person and live online remote learning opportunities for preschool through grade 12. To learn more, visit flsplano.org, flsplano.org.
Many Lutheran pastors outside of the U.S. receive little or no seminary education. Luther Academy provides theological triage through conferences, books, and journals. Help support Luther Academy by making a tax-deductible donation at lutheracademy.com or call 260-452-2211. Serving Lutheran pastors to the ends of the earth, Luther Academy, 260-452-2211 or lutheracademy.com.
Independent and in the black for 12 years and running, you're listening to Issues Etc.
When Martin Luther preached the dedication for the Torgau Church, he asserted that nothing else happened in this house but that our dear Lord speak to us and we respond in prayer, thanksgiving, and praise.
Issues Etc. guest Dr. John Pless.
The same could be said of Concordia Theological Seminary. This is a place where our Lord speaks to us through His Word, and we respond in joyful and thankful confession. We therefore invite you to visit our campus, where the Word of Christ dwells among us richly.
Learn more about studying for the vocations of pastor or deaconess at ctsfw.edu or call 1-800-481-2155. Forming servants in Jesus Christ to teach the faithful, reach the lost, and care for all. Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, ctsfw.edu or 1-800-481-2155.